Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Hey, Augie.
Good morning, Nia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine, in large part because we get to talk about something that I'm pretty sure a big chunk of our listeners might not know about, but for government document geeks like you and me, okay, this is like Christmas. This is like Christmas, Thanksgiving, and Easter all rolled up into one.
I will put to you that when it is called the nation's most treasured publication, that really is it really is true in terms of librarians, but also in terms of historians and political scientists and other people who want to know what came before. And what we are talking about, listeners, is the serial set. So one of the things that we're going to try to do this semester is we're going to try to mix in some old school documents, because we did that a couple of semesters ago with the commission reports.
Yes.
We're going to try to bring back some documents that maybe people don't know about, or they don't know exactly what's in them, and tell you what's going on with that. So
let's be
has a real name.
Yes. Okay. But listeners, when we say cereal, we're not talking about what you might eat, okay, with milk in
right.
the morning.
We're talking about the librarian word, meaning multi-volume.
Yeah, multi-volume.
S-E-R-I-A-L as opposed to C-E-R-E-A-L, which is
correct.
The stuff that you eat.
Yes. And its official name, okay, is the United States Congressional Cereal Set, okay? And its first publication was with the 15th Congress in 1817. Okay. So again, listeners, we're going back a couple centuries. Okay.
And can I interrupt briefly?
Yes.
Okay. So 1817, and you say to yourself, wait, but there was stuff before then. There was stuff before then. It's called the American State Papers. We're not going to do an episode on that unless somebody requests one. The American State Papers gather from 1789 to 1838, and they are the original, like they're from the original Congresses, but they're not organized the same way. Augie's going to tell you more about the organization of the serial set. The American State Papers are organized basically by department, foreign relations, Indian affairs, finances, naval affairs, public lands, right? They're sort of gathered in that way. and they're only 38 volumes. They're not a huge number. It took a while for people to say, hey, you know, wait, we should have a more in-depth history of what we do, and we should gather those documents somewhere so that future generations can look back and read. And that's when you get the serial set.
Yeah, the serial set, it's also sometimes referred to, particularly by people who work in Congress, okay, as the House and Senate reports, okay?
That's a large part of what makes them up. Although there's other stuff in there.
Yes. So what we're talking about with the serial set is a 14,000 bound volumes. Okay. And I said that correctly. 14,000. Okay.
Which is why a lot of libraries don't have the print volumes, because 14,000 is a lot to put on the shelf.
Yeah, you're talking about a rather large storage capacity, okay?
Right. Have them at UVA, if you're wondering, in Virginia.
Yes, they do.
The regional libraries almost all have serial sets.
Yes.
So whatever state you're living in North Carolina, that would be UNC. In Virginia, that would be UVA. It's not always at a university. Sometimes it's at a state library.
Yes.
It is also the depository library. And by depository, we mean part of a larger program where the government sends them a free copy of certain books that they keep so that locally you can read it. Because that's, if you live in Hawaii, getting to DC to read a volume would be super almost impossible.
Yes.
Which is why the University of Hawaii, I think it's the University of Hawaii, is a depository. They get stuff sent to them, and then it's there for their local population to look at.
And think about it in these terms. This is one of those good things that the government does.
Yes. Right?
Because we're talking about the transfer and the transmittance of knowledge. Right.
And transparency, government transparency.
Yeah, okay.
What the heck are they doing over there in Washington? We don't know because we live in Hawaii. And think about 100 years ago, we live in Hawaii and there's no way to fly there. Like, it's not a thing. So,
And these reports did not become known as the serial set until the late 1800s, okay? Particularly 1895, when a decision was made to actually put the numbers of the report on the spine of each volume.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. You know, like 80 years in, somebody thought, hey, shouldn't these be numbered?
So that's why for those of you who look for the serial sets and you come upon a volume pre-1895, you may find the volume number handwritten on the spine. Okay.
Right. With a marker, like Augie's not kidding. Like with a pencil or a marker or a pen.
I was doing research for the episode, Nia, and I actually came across photos. Okay. Of where you could tell. And in some cases, whatever librarian who was tasked, okay, with, you know, maintaining the serial set, I mean, some of them actually like use calligraphy and other kinds of fancy writing, right? But others, okay, you could tell, you know, somebody was just like, oh yeah, this is from, you know, 1883, okay? And, you know, and it's big block printing, right? And you're like, wow, we've come so far in regards to, you know, how we present this. Okay.
And the new volumes are printed on there. The government publishing office, which used to be a government printing office, because the government printing office for years and years was called the government printing office because there was no other kind of publishing.
Yes.
There was only print. And then not too desperately long ago, they changed over to publishing because now, of course, some of what they do is online. Yeah. And some of the serial set is online, but some of it isn't. The Law Library of Congress is going back and digitizing volumes, but they have to do it very carefully because you don't want to destroy the original bound volume.
That's right.
While you're trying to make the digitized, and you also need to make them searchable, and that takes a lot longer. That's a different kind of digitization than just taking a picture.
Yeah, I mean, this is in many ways a challenging technological process, right?
Yes.
And it requires money, and it requires the hiring of some really talented folks to do this kind of work.
Yep.
So what's included in the serial set? Just fascinating stuff. Okay. And Nia, stop me if I, you know, touch upon something that you would like to discuss in more depth. Hold on just a sec. It's one of those things about recording live.
every once in a while, somebody needs to cough.
Yes. You know, the,
but
the,
I can see Augie and he does not have the plague. So we're good.
No, this listeners was the, frog in the throat. Yes. Those damn frogs, always trying to interrupt us. Right.
Ribbit.
So, it has information about, okay, committee reports related to bills and other matters. Presidential communication to Congress.
which you and I have briefly discussed that we think that the State of the Union should be done by email.
Yeah.
That will eventually be included in the serial set if we can ever convince them to do that.
Okay. Treaty materials. Okay. I mean, and think about this, as some of our listeners, particularly those who have had the unfortunate experience of taking constitutional law with me well know, most presidents after FDR have not liked treaties. They rely upon executive agreements, which don't need the confirmation of the United States Senate. But pre-FDR, presidents would negotiate treaties. So all treaty-related materials, okay, that presidents wanted the Senate to consider before voting, that's part of the serial set. Executive Department publications, because the United States Congress was concerned that the executive branch would publish stuff and Congress would not be informed. So they required that executive branch departments convey all their publications to the United States Congress. This would be, for instance, guys, checks and balances, right?
Right.
So what is the executive branch doing with the money we've given them, right?
Oh, look, here's a report.
What you also had non-governmental publications, okay? And you might be thinking, well, what are some of these non-governmental publications, okay? So for instance, where did I go ahead and include? Annual reports of the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts of America. The annual report of the Smithsonian Institution, which in a previous podcast, we had one of our colleagues come in and discuss the Smithsonian, right? The annual report of the Daughters of the American Revolution. The proceedings of the National Convention of the American Legion and the proceedings of the National Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. Okay.
Right. And those are all those quasi governmental. Augie's talked about that in the past, and we can go into more depth of that at some point. But there are some institutions that are both governmental and private. They're a conglomeration of those two things, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Smithsonian. They're not all government and they're not no government. They're the in-between.
Well, in many of these organizations that I just mentioned are patriotic in nature. Okay.
Right.
They are supposed to help develop love, affection, and continued, you know, belief in the American system of governance. Okay, the American form of democracy, all right? But Nia, are there other, okay, important papers?
Well, oh my gosh, everything in there is important. Sorry, it's, for me.
That could be a really long
episode because we would be talking about 14,000 volumes and what's in each one. What I find fascinating is sort of it's not haphazard, that's too strong a word, but documents come in and out of vogue in the serial set.
Yes.
So you'll have, for instance, the Agriculture Yearbook, but it doesn't appear in all of them. It only appears in about 100 80. Of them. Or is it 80? Yeah, about 80 of them.
Yeah, 1894 to 1795.
Right. And then suddenly in 1975, people are like, oh, no more agriculture. That's not true. The Agriculture Yearbook can be found.
Yes. And for
well
those of
beyond,
you,
I mean, up to in, this year, it's still
Nia,
published.
And Nia, what's the Agricultural Yearbook? What's found in the Agricultural
Yearbook?
Oh my
gosh, the Agricultural Yearbook is such a fabulous thing. We should probably do an episode on it. If you wonder how many soybeans the United States produced last year, it can tell you down to the bushel level. Like, it's amazing, because someone somewhere has to count all that. Someone somewhere has to know. Okay, so when you go to Google, because let's be honest, that's how you're going to look it up. You go to Google and you say you say most soybean production in the world, and you get a list of countries, and they tell you how many soybeans they produced. The United States Annual Yearbook, the Agricultural Yearbook is the place where that number comes from for Google.
Yes.
Almost all of those numbers that Google gives you about a country's mineral wealth, or about its agricultural wealth, or about its fishing habits, or all those come from annual reports that the government puts together, because someone is required to do that. Usually when they get authorizing legislation for the money,
yes,
somebody has to give you an annual report about how you spent it. And did it work?
It's not only required by law, okay? There's a larger theoretical purpose behind this, right? If you think about the Enlightenment, an Enlightenment era thinking is predicated on human beings being able to observe and measure the phenomenon that they experience. And if we do that, then we can better figure out how to improve, okay, our lives, our conditions, right?
Exactly.
Okay, and it flows from Enlightenment era thinking, but not only is it required by law, Nia, if the United States is entering into a trade deal with another country,
right,
the United States State Department and the Office of Foreign Trade, okay,
are going to need to know those numbers.
That's right.
They need to know what they're negotiating over.
Yes. Okay. And, you know, making a best
guess. Also, barter doesn't work if you don't know what you have.
Yeah.
Right? Like, hey, man, I'll trade you some soybeans for some corn. And the person says, okay, how many soybeans do you have? And then you say, I'll get back to you on that. Right?
Well, let me guess. Okay.
Exactly.
No, that ain't
gonna work. No. Because then I have to guess how much corn I'm going to give you for it. Like, that's not how that kind of thing works. The Minerals Yearbook is in their weirdly limited years to what, 32 to 68.
Yeah.
And it's not that minerals stopped being important in 68. That's not what happened. It's just that the different minerals that the country exports and imports changed in part because of technology. 68 is when you start to see electronics, which use different kinds of minerals. So it's less important to have it in the serial set, but that report still exists as well. It still comes out annually. So, like, that's the thing which I find fascinating about the serial set, is you can see what's in the political thinking in a given set of years.
Yes.
And then sort of falls out of the political thinking. In 1975, most people were not working on farms. So the agriculture report is less important to Congress people who are representing farmers, because there's fewer of them, right? So it's that kind of thing.
Or you see the creation of new federal agencies who, as part of their authorizing legislation, okay, has to issue a report to the entire country.
Yep.
Okay, so for instance, you see this in regards to the annual reports of the Public Health Service. Well, we no longer have a quote-unquote Public Health Service. Instead, we have a Surgeon General's Office, we have the Centers for Disease Control, and then we have a standalone federal department, Health
HHS.
Health and Human Services, right? So this also tracks, if you will, changes within the executive branch, right? You know, foreign relations papers lasted for 60 years until 1955. Guess what really starts to develop in the mid-1950s? The Cold War, okay? So now, just, you know,
right,
a set of reports from the State Department wasn't going to cut it, right?
Right.
And also, a lot of that information during the Cold War, as we previously discussed, becomes dark or black. Okay, it becomes classified.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're not going to include that in the quote-unquote foreign relations papers. Okay.
My favorite are the patent decisions. Well, no, yes. That's not my favorite. I'm lying. They're all my favorites. I like that the patent decisions, like, were only 1925 to 1953. But when you think about the highly industrialized work that starts to happen in the United States, that totally tracks. That's when...
Yes, yes.
When you get an explosion of technological devices that are trying to build and patent.
But again, think about what started to occur in the 1950s. As the United States begins to engage in a nuclear weapons race with the Soviet Union, and then a space race, a lot of these technological changes, get reflected in other government documents.
Right.
So the patent decisions became less important to Congress, than these other kinds of technological changes. As we've discussed again with, our colleague, Hillary, right? Hillary Miller, right? Patents are still important today, but they became less important to various members of Congress. Because remember, the serial set, are documents that were either submitted to Congress or Congress thought was important.
And that's that right there, that phrase, that's the key phrase, which is that Congress thought was important and should be preserved in a unified fashion.
Yes.
It's not that Congress doesn't think the other stuff is important, but their unified gathering of these documents, that's the point of the serial set, is that it gathers them in one spot, as opposed to you having to hunt them down in various different places. All of those things still exist within the agencies, or the agencies of agencies, because remember, the Department of War became the Department of Defense, right? So,
yes.
And within departments are
agencies, right?
Right.
And some agencies are better at
preserving things than others.
Yeah.
Yes. Which, much to the long-term aggravation of the Government Publishing Office, which is tasked by law with publishing government documents. And so they send out notices to the agencies and say, hey, if you have stuff, we need to get it because we need to send it out. And agencies don't reply. And there is no enforcement. It's too bad there's not a publishing enforcement office that could shut down your agency until you gave them your reports for the year. That would be really cool. More money for you. Don't come to work until you give us a report.
Armed individuals, with,
that would shut down the building and
with staple guns.
That's right.
And highlighters who are
we'll need your annual reports, please. Yeah. All dressed all in black with sunglasses. Be awesome.
Well, and by the way, listeners, if it seems like we're beating up on executive branch agencies, that's not our intent.
No.
Even Congress, is. And again, this is one of the fascinating things about the serial set, right?
Yeah, what's not in it is just as interesting as what's in it.
And a lot of times, the House and the Senate is not good. They haven't been good at preserving and maintaining what they've done, because, again, the House and Senate reports, are a designated class of publications which congressional committees formally report and make recommendations to the Senate or the House concerning what they've done. But it's not a full report of what the committees do,
Right.
So
what's not in there are things like debates,
congressional debates.
texts of the hearings a lot of times are not in there. Some are, because if something is big enough, like for instance, the Clinton Lewinsky scandal hearings are in there. Iran-Contra is in there. Right. So sometimes there is something in there. Teapot Dome scandal is in there. Right. Yeah. Those things that are reported, like, so part of it is, I know it seems like it's arbitrary, but what it is that if Congress thinks that something is potentially nation altering or history altering, they will include it in some way. For instance, the Titanic. They held hearings about the failure of the Titanic. Guess which committee did that? Augie, can you name the committee that did that?
No, I don't know.
It is the Committee on Commerce. Because if you're going to have people going back and forth across the, right? Like, people is commerce. And so Commerce held hearings because they wanted to know if this was going to happen again. Is this going to keep happening? Because that's terrible, right?
Yep, that makes sense.
That's actually included. But then other things aren't included. Like, because part of it is that they have to decide whether to include in the time, and they don't have the historical knowledge that you have when you look back 20 years and say, oh, they probably should have included that hearing because it turned out to be hugely important. At the time, they held the hearing and didn't know it was important, and so they didn't include it. So,
and that's why
it's a good thing that all these documents are also in other places, because if a scholar finds out they exist, they can go find them.
Yeah, I mean, think of this as the
highlight reel. The serial set's sort of the highlight.
The highlight reel. And I'm glad you described it that way, because it really does show, it chronicles, listeners, how or what was important throughout our country's history. And it doesn't capture everything, but it really gives you a sense of the changing interests, passions, points of focus for the United States Congress, right?
And it also includes odd, like, stuff that you think, why in the world? Okay, what it doesn't include, it does not include presidential proclamations or executive orders, but it does include the economic report of the president, which, by the way, takes up like 64 volumes each time. It's not really 64. It's like 3 or 4 volumes because it's huge.
Yeah, it's huge.
And it's its own, it's in the serial set. Sometimes what you get are individual volumes that are a thing. And so you'll get an individual numbered volume that is the economic report of the president, right? But things like vetoes are all in there because it's really important to Congress when the president vetoes what they've sent across. Again, your checks and balances thing, which I think is fascinating, one of the more fascinating. But can I talk about a little thing that's in there that, well, it's not a little thing, but it's big to me, that makes me excited about the, when people say, oh, it's all boring and it's all blah, blah, blah. So anybody who's ever been to DC has heard of L'Enfant Plaza.
Yes.
And it's named for Pierre L'Enfant, who was the architect of the city of Washington. And he asked Jefferson. So he was appointed by Washington, who I'm sure took him to this swampy mess and said, see, it's going to make a great city. And I'm sure he thought to himself, you are a nutcase.
No, but it ain't.
But nobody ever said that to George Washington. You're a nutcase, sir. So he asked Jefferson, he said, can I get from you maps and data from London, Madrid, Paris, Amsterdam, Naples, Venice, and Florence? Now notice three of those are Roman cities, right? Naples, Venice, and Florence.
Yes.
Hence the enormous influence that you can see in Washington, D.C. of the Roman, right, the columns and the big tall buildings and the whole, like, we will make it edificy. But all of those plans are in the serial set.
Yes.
Because somebody said to themselves, this is going to be really important for scholars one day. They're going to want to know what we were doing when we planned this city. And at the time, I think Washington said only St. Petersburg outstrips this city in terms of capital cities of nations because it's been so deeply planned.
Yes.
Park system, the streets. He knew early on that he wanted streets going in one direction to be alphabetical and streets going in the other direction to be numerical.
Numerical, yes.
So like the whole thing is just, and it's amazing. It's really cool. And you can look at all his maps and read his notes. And
again, this reflects Enlightenment era thinking because, you know, the architect was just like, what can we learn from the best constructed cities of the world?
Right. Capitals. And the most beautiful.
Yes.
And the most beautiful. We want beautiful cities.
Yes. We want the citizens of this country to be proud of its capital, like citizens of capital cities around the world,
right,
you know, are proud of, take ownership of. And again, this reflects Enlightenment era thinking. We can observe what others have done, okay, or what's going on, and then we can decide what to change, what to improve, what to keep, okay, et cetera. It is fascinating. Nia, you mentioned in our notes in preparation for this episode, the Louisiana Purchase, right?
Right.
In the letter that Jefferson wrote to basically tell the United States Congress, I've already negotiated this deal. I basically now want you guys to pay for it, right? To me, that's just remarkable, right? To have that recorded, okay? Because there's no interpretation there. I mean, Jefferson basically went ahead and did this. And what's truly remarkable is Jefferson was a president, before he became president, okay, was extremely skeptical and fearful of national government power, but in particular, presidential power until he became president. Okay, I mean, it's a really fascinating example of Miles' Law, right? Where you stand is where you sit, okay? Because if you're not president, you're like, yeah, we got to be concerned about the president exercising too much power. But then when you become president, you're like, well, I got to do some important stuff here for the country. You know, how do we make sure that we, you know, protect our westernmost border? Well, we go ahead and buy a whole bunch of land. Right? We make the Louisiana Purchase, right?
1803, I think.
Yeah. Yep.
Something.
Yeah.
Right. And we negotiate with France, which of course Jefferson loved because he loved France.
Yes.
And was, so it's that kind of thing that ends up in the serial set. And part of what a librarian will tell you that the reason that the serial set is so important is because it is important for a nation to gather its historical material and keep it for future generations, because we never know what's going to be important to historians of the future. We don't know. When someone proposes a piece of legislation, right? We don't know if it's going to end up being a huge pattern across their life.
Yes.
Where they are, for instance, the Udalls, right? The Udall brothers who served in the Congress did huge amounts of work with the interior and environment and all that kind of stuff in the 50s and 60s before Earth Day, before it became a thing.
Yes.
They were working on that. And we did, at the time, nobody would have known that that was going to be the arc of their legacy.
Yes.
So that's part of what's so important about the serial set is it's not just for political science students, it's also for historians. It's also for people who want to, as you said, see the connections that get made across a long-term set of documents. what's important, what's not important, what gets included, what doesn't get included. And for a long time, the statistical abstracts was included. And we may do an episode on the statistical abstracts because it's my single favorite document of all the documents. If we used to ask, and I love them all, which says something to you. We used to say to people when they got hired into the government documents department where I worked at North Carolina State, what's your favorite government document and why? And for me, it was the statistical abstracts because it's tables and tables and tables. It's labor tables, it's education tables, everything. If you want to know a mathematical yes. thing about the United States, the statistical abstracts had it in there. So if you were answering reference questions by phone on a desert island, which I don't know why you would do that, then you really, that's all you needed was the stat abs. And so I love the stat abs. But it also shows you, like, one of the things that you can track in something like the statistical abstracts is a city's population decline.
Yes.
So if you want to know how many people left Detroit between 1980 and 2000, the statistical abstracts will show you that. It's that kind of thing that allows us to answer these sort of sociological questions about yes. us as a society.
Society, because, and again, it's the difference between what we perceive and what we know, right? Because, you know, the statistical abstracts measure things, right?
Right.
You know, population increase or population decline. How many people work in the medical profession versus how many people work in agriculture versus how many people work in retail, right? You know, right. how many Americans commute 5 to 10 miles to work every day versus 15 to 20, right? Okay, these are all the kinds of things that are in the statistical abstract. And I've told reporters, I'm like, you know, if you guys want to know the background on a story that you're doing, okay, you know, find it, you know, go to your library or today, you know, go online and bookmark the U.S. statistical abstracts.
Right.
Okay. Because you can verify, you can learn, you can know, you can write informed questions of, you know, elected officials, government officials, people involved in stories. You can ask informed questions because of the statistical abstracts.
And they were in there from 1879 to 1976.
Six, yes.
Like, that's a lot of years.
Yes.
And it's interesting you come at it from such a professional point of view of you can ask these intelligent yes. questions of, whereas I come at it from a storytelling point of view. Those numbers tell a story.
Yeah.
Those numbers, as you see people in agriculture stop working in agriculture and the rise of other jobs, that tells a story. That tells a story about the American experience and who we are as a people. Sorry, I will wax poetic for days if we allow me.
Oh, no. I mean,
that's why I love the serial set, because I think that it tells a very long, involved story about the United States.
Yes.
And are there things missing? Absolutely. There are things that are missing. There are things that we don't have a lot of storytelling of racial problems in this country. We don't have a lot of storytelling of our native population and the things that happened with our native population. So there are some gaps. I'm not suggesting that it's in any way perfect, because it's not.
But even the gaps
tell a story.
Yep. Okay. I mean, because, you know, listeners, Nee and I have mentioned this a couple times during this episode. Okay. What in part fascinates both of us about the serial set is what's not included, or what was included for the periods of time that it was. Okay. Right. Nia, before we conclude this episode, can you guess, okay, what feature of the serial set, okay, first exposed me or turned me on to the value of the serial set?
Oh my gosh. I have no idea.
I took an undergraduate class in public administration at the University of Pittsburgh. And one of our assignments, okay, was to, we had a list of things that we could pick and we had to go find them, okay, in the government documents section of the university library. And I picked, okay, the annual budget of the United States. And the annual budget of the United States, okay, beginning in fiscal year 1923, is included in the serial set, okay? And in some of the volumes, there are actually, there were actually handwritten notes, okay, of changes or the inclusion of appendices, okay, for a particular fiscal year's budget. And that just fascinated me. I was just like, I could not believe that there was a single source, okay, of the federal government's annual budget, okay? And for listeners who have faithfully listened to our podcast, you know, through the various, you know, the various years, you know, one of in my estimation, one of the best set of episodes is where Nia and I discussed the budget process, right? Okay.
The nightmare that is the budget process.
The process. But for those of you who are like, you know, why was Augie so enthusiastic about the U.S. budget? It goes back to, okay, a simple assignment in a class when I was an undergrad. And I had a government documents librarian at the University of Pittsburgh who was just like, well, Mr. Augenbaugh, let me show you an important document. And I was just like, a important document? Okay, it's the budget. How freaking important can it be? And she goes, let me introduce you to the serial set. And I was just like, okay.
Now,
and there were all the budgets.
Okay. See, they're house doc, they're listed as house documents, I think. I could be wrong about that. The thing about the serial set for me is that it is, one, it's a history of the United States, but also I like the weird things you come across,
yes,
when you're looking for something else, because the serial set is like early Wikipedia,
yeah,
right? You're on your way to an annual budget report and you're like, wait, what's this volume on this? And you pull it down and you start looking and then you're like, dude, and you get totally sidetracked.
Yes.
That's one of the magical things about, to me, about
if you are even remotely curious,
right, it's gonna suck you in for days, weeks, months, potentially the rest of your life. It's just totally fascinating. Now, before we go, I want to mention many libraries no longer have physical volumes of the serial set. They are coming online as they get digitized, and I will put the links for that in the research guide. And there are several libraries that have done some of that work, and there's a huge number of upright 14,000 volumes. It's going to take a while for it to all make it up there.
Yes.
But do keep in mind that any library can borrow a volume for you.
Yes.
If there's something you want to look at, any they're almost all lendable from depository libraries, or they can copy out specific pages if what you're interested in is something as simple as the map of Washington versus if you want the annual report of the, you know, if you want the annual budget, you're going to need volumes. You're going to need to ask for volumes, but you can do that at your local library. Because your local librarians will be delighted to get those for you. Trust me, there's when anybody comes up with a serial set question, it's very exciting for government documents librarians because we're like, really? You want to play in the serial set? Excellent. Let me help you. So,
yeah, folks, it's Nia's excitement right now is it's too bad you guys can't see it. What's comparable for me is when a student comes up to me and says, Professor Augenbaugh, do you know about proposed regulation X coming from this department? And I'm like, well, let's go look in the Federal Register, okay?
Yeah, to see your whole world is administrative law, and that's what the Federal Register is.
Yeah, right? And students are just like, okay, you need to really like calm down, Professor Augenbaugh, because this is getting a little weird.
This isn't that interesting. And you're like, oh, but wait, it is. Look at this. Look at this.
yeah, right?
Exactly. Okay. That's how I feel about the serial set.
Like, okay. Oh. And then they, you know, in the proposed rule has references, you know, to other regulations. Exactly. And I'm like, oh, let's go look at those other regulations.
Exactly.
And they're like, no. I just want to go. I want to know about X. And I'm like,
oh,
do really? You really only want to know about X?
Okay.
Do you really?
Okay. All right. Oh my goodness. We invite you listeners to play around with your local serial set wherever you are. And if you don't have access, like I said, I'll put up the links.
Yes.
Thank you, Augie. I love the serial set. So thank you for talking to me about it.
Oh, no. I mean, when months ago you went ahead and said, can we talk about the serial set? I was just like, oh, yes.
For days.
For days, right? But fortunately for you all listeners, we kept it to about 40 to 45 minutes. but again, like Nia just mentioned, strongly encourage you to explore the serial set. It does tell a story about the country, and it's fascinating what we have collected, what we have observed, measured. The reports, it is a fascinating history.
It's magic.
Yep.
Thank you, Augie.
Thank you, Nia.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this podcast.